case 18-2188, Tang versus MSPB. I think we're ready whenever you are, sir.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'm George Chusey, and I'm representing Dr. Cindy Tang, who is a FDA scientist who reviews drugs for the FDA. In 2015, Dr. Tang disclosed that her superiors had committed two violations of law, rule, or regulation in conjunction with...
I appreciate that.
Okay.
I think we understand what went down here.
Okay.
This case is a bit striking because I think this person was lawyered. I don't know if you were the lawyer, but this person had your client had a lawyer at the time of filing all this stuff with the MSPB, right?
It was me.
Okay. Well, didn't you get like two notices to show cause just asking for you to cull out a huge stack of paper, the fundamental issues that one needs to decide in determining whether or not a case is frivolous? And it seems to me you didn't do this, certainly not the first time, and even the second time. It required for the administrative judge to get his mind around what was going on here to call themselves into the record. Don't you think this was a bit unusual in terms of requiring the AJ to do stuff that, I mean, some might argue that the AJ could have just stopped that and given the responses you had to the notice to show cause, just said, not enough, goodbye.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that the judge was fair when he reached that conclusion. What I did in our supplemental brief was I laid out what the legal issues were in terms of the missed deadlines. I then indicated which were the disclosures and what those disclosures showed. I did not quote the emails in my supplemental submission to the judge.
So you did identify the statutory provisions that were supposedly violated?
Yes.
You did disclose the protected disclosures, when they were made, who they were made to?
No. The when they were made and to whom they were made are not relevant factors in jurisdiction. The fact of the matter is Dr. Tang identified the violations of law, rule, or regulation. I identified those in our brief, and I directed the judge to the relevant emails in which those disclosures were made. In fact, Judge Niedrich quoted from my emails. He objected to the fact that he had to actually look them up, but he quoted the emails whose references I provided to him. He then found that Dr. Tang had not reasonably disclosed violations of law, rule, or regulation, but those findings were reached on non-relevant, non-applicable factors. He found that Dr. Tang merely had arguments with her superiors about how these deadlines were missed. In the second disclosure, he found as fact that Dr. Tang was essentially holding her superiors responsible for violations that she had engaged in.
So can I ask, I guess I'm just trying to understand the jurisdictional limits of the non-frivolous part of this test. Suppose that she had accused one of her superiors of crashing a government vehicle.
Yes.
Okay. But suppose there really is no reasonable dispute that her superior was not even in the car and that she was the driver.
Okay.
Would that be something that, as a matter of fact, the MSPB judge would be permitted to say to a non-frivolous allegation because there really is no reasonable dispute? These are not the facts of your case, even at all or even close. So don't, I know that. But I guess you're saying he or she, I don't know, the AJ in this case, reached findings of fact that were beyond the purview of what they should have done at this stage in the proceeding.
That's right.
And I am just trying to ascertain what kinds of facts they can think about in the context of deciding whether an allegation is not frivolous or not. So go to my hypothetical.
Yes.
If there's really just no dispute that her supervisor was not in the car and that she was the driver of the vehicle, would the AJ be free at that point to say, I find that you were the driver, not your supervisor, and as such, this case is dismissed because there's no non-frivolous allegation?
Understanding that there's no decision by this court that addresses that particular point. In Watson, a case decided, a case cited by the government, this court held at a hearing, after a hearing, that if the evidence disclosed that the violation was the result of conduct by the discloser, that in all likelihood, the board would not have jurisdiction over that claim. I think in response to your question, Judge Moore, if in fact the evidence is indisputable, then I believe a judge may very well, based on the principles that are at play here, a judge may very well find that the it was not a non-frivolous disclosure. We don't have undisputable evidence in this case. And in Piccolo, this court made absolutely clear that it's not the judge's job on a jurisdictional question to weigh evidence, evaluate credibility, and reach a decision as to who was right and who was wrong. We haven't had an opportunity to take
sure.
this.
I mean, we said there's no weighing of evidence at the jurisdictional issue, but
yes.
it does. We haven't prohibited the board judge from looking at the entire record, have we? I believe we've said that this is akin to a summary judgment determination, where you look at the record and determine whether there's any genuine issue of material fact, right?
Yes, and what I'm...
And in doing that, even if your client made certain allegations, the board can look at the record and say, well, she may have made that allegation, but there's nothing to support it, so I find no genuine issue.
But there was nothing...
District court judges do that all the time, don't
well,
they?
Well, yes and no. I mean, in this particular case, all the evidence that the judge had were the email disclosures. And I will grant that the agency superiors who were the subjects of the disclosures, they had their arguments as to why they had not engaged in a violation. For each of their arguments, Dr. Tang had a responsive email, sometimes going for multiple pages, arguing why the superiors' suggestions were not accurate. In that case, I don't believe a judge could grant summary judgment.
Even if her reasons were entirely frivolous?
But how could anybody judge whether her reasons are frivolous without looking at the underlying record and without giving us the opportunity to examine or cross-examine?
We have the record. We have the emails and the back and forth, which was what the disclosures were.
Dr. Tang clearly raised the disclosures that her superiors had violated these deadlines and the review requirements. They
right,
said
we
they...
We have all the evidence in the record about what the deadlines were, what the submissions were, when she made it, the deficiencies they noted, and all the like. They can't weigh whether she was right or her superiors were right if they find them both potentially credible, but they can say, can't they, looking at this record, no reasonable person could conclude that she made a protected disclosure.
No, I don't believe that is an appropriate conclusion on jurisdictional.
Do you believe that they can't legally do that, or that it was improper here because there was a genuine issue?
I believe both. I don't.
So you say that in a whistleblower case, yes, an administrative judge can't look at the record before it and apply what we call an analogous summary judgment standard and say there's no genuine issue of material fact as to whether there was a non-frivolous disclosure here.
I believe a judge can do that. I don't believe...
If that's what he or she did here, then there's no legal error.
I disagree, because I think what the judge did was he looked at the superior's arguments, he looked at Dr. Tang's arguments, and he concluded that theirs was more likely to be true than hers. And I don't believe that's appropriate. I believe that is exactly, with all due respect, Judge, I think that is exactly weighing the evidence and reaching conclusions based on disputed evidence, which he is not permitted to do. It's undisputed that Dr. Tang accused her superiors of violating these requirements. They have their arguments. There's no dispute that the requirements were violated. The government admits in its brief at page 11 that the prescription drug requirement had a due date. The two of them had a due date of June 15th and June 16th. And the ultimate review...
Let me ask you a hypothetical that's a little bit closer to the facts of the case. If she made a disclosure and said, you caused me to miss this deadline, and her superiors responded and said, we didn't cause you to miss the deadline at all. We did nothing. You submitted the initial request a month after the deadline. And she said nothing in response to that. Would that be a non-frivolous allegation that her superiors had caused her to miss the deadline?
If Dr. Tang did not dispute her supervisor's version of the facts, then it might have been possible for Judge Niedrich to decide that was worthy of summary judgment.
I mean, how could he not? If the only person that caused the missed deadline was Dr. Tang, then no reasonable person could believe that the supervisors caused it.
If, in fact, she did not dispute their version, she did dispute their version. In each of these instances...
Right, but we have actual documentary evidence here, right?
But the evidence of the emails...
Does she dispute that she sent these emails or that her superiors responded?
She disputes their timeline in each instance.
But we know what the timeline of the emails are, aren't they? Judge,
it's not the timeline of the emails. It's the timelines that amount to the superior's defense to the claims that they violated.
You mean like the timelines, like whether she submitted at 4 o'clock on June 14th and only gave them so many days to review it, those timelines? Is that what you're talking about?
In that same email, Judge Moore, Dr. Tang indicated that even though her superior had said, you didn't submit anything until June 15th, giving her only one day, Dr. Tang said, in fact, I submitted it on May 29th. And she had 2 weeks, and I wasn't told to make any amendments to these until such and such a day, at which time I did them virtually immediately. And then I handed in what I was supposed to hand in on June 15th, and the superiors did not address that until July 27th, I believe. The deadline was violated. Who was responsible for it is a disputed question of fact.
Oh, why don't we hear from the other side? Do you have any comments?
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'd like to start to briefly correct the record. The review that was submitted the last minute that Judge Moore just pointed out was review 5358, and the one that was submitted at May 29th was actually a separate review, review 202. So I believe my friend here was inaccurate in stating that. But going to the hypothetical that Judge Moore and Judge Hughes both presented, I believe that's the key issue here. What it comes down to is if a petitioner alleges that her supervisor crashed a government car and then submits, or she disclosed her supervisor crash a government car and then submits hundreds of pages of documents actually showing her supervisor did not crash the government car. At the non-frivolous stage, the administrative judge is going to assume all the documents she submitted in support of her disclosure are true and make a reasonable belief assessment based on those documents. And when the documents show that the supervisor did not crash the government car, then the judge is going to determine that the appellant did not make a non-frivolous allegation that she reasonably believed she disclosed a violation of law. And this court nor the board have never held.
You know, that's a really easy case, and my hypothetical was a really, really easy case too. This one is a lot of emails back and forth about fairly detailed procedures and the like, and there is at least seems to be arguments back and forth between her and her supervisors about what's going on. Why isn't that kind of the quintessential issue that should have been left for a trial before the administrative judge rather than just go off at the non-frivolous stage?
Because they don't actually dispute the key facts for the reasonable belief test about that disclosure in terms of who is at fault. Her exact wording in her second jurisdictional submission after she was given a second chance to explain it was, appellant disclosed three instances in which her supervisor, Patricia Hughes, refused to work on appellant's work product, specifically two reviews, I'll skip the name of the reviews, thereby causing the two reviews to violate the PDUFA. But then when you look at all the email traffic between them, you see a series of emails from Ms. Hughes between May 29th and June 15th, in which she sent her three separate sets of revisions for that review. And the petitioner never disputes that Ms. Hughes did send her three separate sets of revisions in that time. So that part is never disputed between the two parties. And so based on that, the judge determined the petitioner simply could not reasonably believe, nor could an objective person in the same scenario reasonably believe that the petitioner or that Ms. Hughes refused to work on her work product in that time period and thereby caused violations of the PDUFA. And moving on to my friend just pointed out before that he cited the statutes in his jurisdictional submission. The statute he cited for disclosure three about the violation of PDUFA, as I pointed out in our brief, doesn't actually seem to contain the requirement he claims it does. It's nowhere in there as far as I can tell, and he provided no explanation as to why this was an actual requirement, which is particularly striking when his supervisor or her supervisors in the emails also told her, this is not a requirement, we don't need to do this. And so without further explanation about that statute, it's nothing more than a conclusory allegation, and it certainly does not establish that an objective person would reasonably believe that she disclosed a violation of law when she said she disclosed that Mr. Q, I believe is pronounced, and Ms. Hughes needed to sign these reviews. And just going back to what my friend said about this being a merits determination,
Let me ask you another question. So there were multiple instances disclosed. You addressed one of them saying that there were three rounds of revisions, so it's not true. You think the judge can conclude it's not true. It's just not true what Dr. Tang said about non-responsiveness and that that's what caused it to be late. There's a second one where the allegation is that the supervisor was late, and on this one, she submitted her review at 4 o'clock on June 12th for a June 16th deadline. June 12th happened to be a Friday. And the government's response, which the administrative judge accepted, was, well, her supervisor didn't get it till after 4 o'clock on June 12th, which means she really didn't get it till Monday morning. First off, who leaves it before 4 o'clock on a Friday? I mean, I don't know about that. And then doesn't check their email the weekend. But okay, maybe not. But still, she got it Monday morning. There's no evidence in this record that it was impossible for the supervisor to turn it around in 24 hours. Like, that feels to me like the kind of fact question for which further development would help. How do we know that receiving it on Monday morning didn't give the supervisor enough time to issue it on Tuesday? The allegation is my supervisor caused it to be late. What we don't have is anything that explains what needed to occur and why getting it at 4 o'clock on a Friday would prevent the supervisor from having it done in a timely fashion by Tuesday, close of business on Tuesday. So why isn't that the kind of allegation? It doesn't seem, that one doesn't seem as clear to me as the earlier one where she said, I gave it to her and my supervisor did nothing, when in fact there were three back and forths disclosed in the actual emails she presented. You know, so that one I feel more comfortable with, but what about the second one?
In the second one, her response to her supervisors when they accused her of that was actually, no matter when I submit it to her, she won't get it on time. She never disputes again that it was not in a timely fashion, and submitting something such as
what are you talking about? She said this submission by her supervisor was untimely. Her supervisor didn't review this and have it in issuance form, and the deadline was close of business June 16th. And she says, I gave it to her June 12th.
Yes,
and your, the only response I saw by the government was, well, that was a, there was a weekend in between, which baffled me, but okay.
Is ignoring all aspects of the Anti-Deficiency Act and whether somebody can work on the weekend, because a petitioner did not allege that. Her only response in when she was accused of submitting it late was that it doesn't matter when I submit it, it'll be late regardless. So she doesn't dispute that she submitted it late, and if she wants to make a non-frivolous allegation that that was sufficient time, that's on the petitioner. That's not a fact that the judge is going to assume that she can do it within one day. If the petitioner wants to...
Well, wait, but you want the judge to assume because she, the employee, submitted it late, therefore her boss didn't commit a violation when the boss issued it late.
What we're
that's
saying...
a fact. That's how late, right? What if, look, sometimes I give my law clerks false deadlines, right? They got to get me their bench memos 2 weeks in advance of court. Well, if they get it to me 13 days in advance of court, I'm probably not going to sit here and tell you I'm unprepared because my law clerks only gave it to me 13 days in advance instead of 14 days in advance.
Because when she's making a non-frivolous allegation that her boss caused this review to be late, she has to explain why, when her boss tells her, or her second-level supervisor tells her, this was late and you didn't give your supervisor enough time.
That's a good question. Why does she have to explain it? She says, my supervisor was late. Government's response is not, the supervisor wasn't late. Government's response is, well, that's because you were late in submitting it. I don't see how that's not a fact question. I don't see how that falls on the line of non-frivolous allegation.
Because she has to disclose...
Maybe she was complicit in the lateness, but doesn't that something somebody's got to figure out?
Well, she has to explain enough such that there is something to figure out. The judge isn't going to assume that was
on
time.
The judge... But why? Wait, why? Why isn't the judge going to assume... All the judge has to say, was this late or not? Yes, it was late. She may or may not have been the reason it was late, but we don't know.
Well, I think what the judge...
How do we know clearly on the facts at this stage in the proceeding?
What the judge has to determine here is whether she reasonably believed in the truth of her disclosure, which is that Ms. Hughes caused the review to be late. And in order for her to establish that an objective person would reasonably believe...
Is there any evidence the supervisor didn't approve this such that the whole thing happened by the deadline?
The only indication in the record... Oh, yes, I don't believe this one was approved by the deadline. I think that's in the record.
So she has made an allegation that this did not issue by the deadline. She has made an allegation that my supervisor is responsible for that. The government's response at the pleading stage is, well, you were responsible for it because you gave it to your supervisor beyond her deadline to you, late. But, I mean, do you not see how my example demonstrates that, I mean, maybe all the supervisors should do on these things is sign and then issue. I mean, there's lots of things I get. I just have to sign. I mean, not necessarily in this job, actually, but in other parts of my life. Just sign it, send it in. I mean, maybe the supervisor didn't have a significant substantive role to play on this. We don't know because we're at the allegations stage. So we have no idea, based on just the allegations that have been lodged, whether or not this was enough time for the supervisor or not.
But part of the allegation is the document she submitted in support of this disclosure. And what that document states is her supervisor, second level, Ms. Enzor, tells her, this was late because you submitted it basically on the last day or the Friday before. And then her response is not, no, it's not. It's Ms. Hughes' fault. Her response is, no matter when I submit it to Ms. Hughes, it's going to be late, so it doesn't matter.
Your view is that we're not just looking at whether it was late or not, because the disclosure is the supervisor caused it to be late, and as we look at the record, which we're entitled to do, there's no genuine issue that it wasn't her supervisor's fault.
Yes, and that's reflected.
I mean, it does seem, this one seems really close.
Yes, but when you have
But you do have the email you keep quoting from Dr. Tang that says, I don't really care whether it was going to be late or not, whether I made the deadline, because it's going to be late no matter what.
Yes, and so she never disputes Ms. Enzor's accusation saying this was late because you submitted it really late, close to the deadline. She only responds, I don't care when I submitted it.
The thing we're supposed to accept at the pleading stage is all of the allegations made by the pleader. We're not supposed to accept as true the government's responses.
Yes, but...
So you want me to accept as true the supervisor's statement that you're the reason it's late, not me, in order to then say this is frivolous.
I believe this actually gets back to your original hypothetical on, admittedly, the much easier question. When she submits documentation contradicting her own allegation, the board's going to accept that true, too, even if it contradicts her alleged disclosure. When she submits a documentation or submits an email in support of her disclosure saying in response, it doesn't matter when I submit this, the board's going to accept that to be true, even if it harms her allegation. We're going to basically adjudicate, assuming everything she submits it's true, whether or not it harms her alleged disclosure. And that email undermined her own claim that Ms. Hughes caused the missed deadline for review 5358. If this court has no further questions, I ask that we affirm the decision of the board.
Thank you.
I just have briefly, Your Honor, the government's argument that Ms. Tang was arguing that because the June 15th or June 16th PDUFA dates were late, that was the violation. We cited the judge to the July 29th, 2015 email from Dr. Tang to her supervisor, and that's in the appendix at page 121. And in there, it's July 29th, and Dr. Tang specifically says, this is paragraph 3, additionally, to date, you have not yet responded to the revised memo that was sent to you on June 16th, 2015. In paragraph 4, she says, you should also be responsible for 538 because you used inconsistent standards, and to date, you have not responded to the IR draft that I sent to you on June 15th. This is July 29th that we're talking about. The government has no explanation for that, and this is one of the disclosures.
Wait, is that the one that she sent on Friday at 4 o'clock, June 12th? You said the one she sent on June 15th or June 16th. I just want to make sure that we're talking about the same disclosure. I don't know.
There were two disclosures.
Okay.
One was number 202. The other was number 5358.
But you're talking about the first one now.
I'm talking about both. In her July 29th email to her supervisor, she raises the fact that even 6 weeks after she submitted whatever the government says was late from her, the government had still not acted upon those applications. And Dr. Tang is reasonably arguing that those were the violations. She's not arguing one day. She's arguing 6 weeks. And that's page 121, paragraphs 3 and 4. And that's why I believe the judge could not simply accept the superior's arguments and find that the board lacked jurisdiction.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Both sides, and the case is submitted. This concludes our proceeding for this morning.
All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned from day to day.